Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's John Dennis on Friday, September the 19th. Today, after a week that's seen big beasts of the markets brought to their knees, financial authorities in the US and in Britain begin cracking down on the city money men.
I think there are certain areas they think definitely need to be addressed. One is the whole question of short selling. The mood in the markets is still very, very nervous and jittery.
We look at the political repercussions of the tumultuous events on the markets. A lifeline for Gordon Brown?
It's a political lifeline, he hopes, I think, for his own prospects and for Labour's prospects.
Also today, Israel is on course to have its first female prime minister in more than 30 years.
Livni is Mrs. Clean. There's never been any suggestion that she's, you know, besmirched in any way. So that, I think, people are pleased about.
And corruption in Bulgaria threatens to derail its funding from the European Union.
The real problem about Bulgaria, this is what the EU has been demanding or insisting on, has been high-level political corruption. These are the connections between businesses and the government.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis from guardian.co.uk.
But first, Sandy Waugh with the headlines and a look at the papers.
A temporary ban on short selling has been imposed by the government following a promise from Gordon Brown to clean up the city. Short selling has been blamed by some analysts for driving down the shares in HBOS. The practice, which had been banned for 4 months, involves borrowing stock and selling it on in the hope of buying it back at a lower price before then returning it to the original owner. Meanwhile, in the United States, officials have vowed to come up with a comprehensive rescue plan to help rid US banks of their bad assets. The announcement has sparked a rise in the stock market in New York and Asia. Follow the latest details on all this at guardian.co.uk/business. The head of the National Black Police Association, Commander Ali Desai, has been suspended from duty for allegedly wasting police time, perverting the course of justice, assault and unlawful arrest. The move will reignite the race route at the top of Scotland Yard following the suspension last week of Tariq Gafour, who is suing the Met for racial discrimination. Desai was previously suspended in 2001 when the force alleged he was a danger to national security, had consorted with prostitutes and taken illegal drugs. He was later cleared unanimously by an Old Bailey jury. The United States is seeking $20 billion from its allies to help stabilise Afghanistan, and it plans to send thousands more troops to the country, according to American officials. The American Defence Secretary Robert Gates said lessons had been learnt from Iraq. That means more forces. It remains unclear, however, whether Britain will increase its military presence in Afghanistan from the current level of 7,800. Des Brown, the British Defence Secretary, said Afghanistan would remain a long-term problem. Japan's agriculture minister Seishi Ota has resigned following a contaminated rice scandal that prompted a mass recall of alcoholic drinks and has shaken the country's reputation for food safety. One company's admitted it sold hundreds of tons of inedible rice intended for use as fertilizer to businesses across Japan. Seishi Ota conceded that his officials had not conducted proper safety checks for years before resigning. Golf's most prestigious team event begins today as Europe take on the USA in Kentucky for the Ryder Cup. The Americans will hope a vocal home support can help them break European dominance of the trophy in recent years. Follow all the action live with minute-by-minute reports at guardian.co.uk/sport from 1 p.m. BST. In football, wins in the UEFA Cup last night for Manchester City, Portsmouth, Aston Villa and Spurs. Everton drew 2-2 with Standard Liège and Motherwell lost 1-0 to Nancy in France. Now for a look at today's papers, which are once again dominated by the extraordinary events unfolding this week in the city. The Telegraph focuses on revelations that HBOS Chief Executive Andy Hornby will receive shares worth almost £2 million following the company's emergency takeover by Lloyds TSB. The Express greets the ban on short selling with the headline, "Curb on the City Spivs," and "About Time Too." The Economist is more circumspect, though. Its editorial says that financial capitalism may have taken a knock this week, but it has helped produce healthy economic growth for a generation, and it would take a very big recession indeed to wipe out those gains. An opinion poll in The Independent has more bad news for Gordon Brown. It shows 54% of Labour activists would prefer a new leader in time for the next general election. The Times, meanwhile, devotes two pages and a large graphic to the theory that Hazel Blears could have been behind recent attempts by Labour rebels to unseat the Prime Minister. In The Sun, we get the news that killers and rapists are receiving incapacity benefit while they're detained in mental institutions. They get £95 every week, says the paper. The back pages are dominated by the Ryder Cup, with Europe's captain Nick Faldo pictured trying to hold back tears as emotions ran high at yesterday's press conference. More news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
We're cleaning up the financial system. That's what Gordon Brown said yesterday, signalling a new era of regulation in the city. The Prime Minister was closely involved in the £12.2 billion takeover of HBOS by Lloyds TSB, which involved breaking Gordon Brown's competition rules. Our economics editor Larry Elliott explains what the government plans to do.
Well, there are certain things that the government thinks now have to be done. I mean, I've been speaking to members of the government and trying to find out what Brown meant by that. And I think there are certain areas that they think definitely need to be addressed. One is the whole question of short selling of stocks, which is where people borrow shares they don't have, sell them and then buy them back at a lower price. The government's particularly worried about the short selling of bank shares because it thinks that these banks are vital to the whole community. And if they go down, then it has really massive implications for the whole of Britain. So that's one area they want to look at. And another area they want to look at is trade in some of these very complex derivatives, which only a few boffins and eggheads seem to understand and have caused immense problems, because these are the sort of mortgage-backed securities and products derived from those, which have gummed up the entire global financial system for the past 13 months. And so they want to look at those. I mean, and the view is that it would be ridiculous after the scale of the credit crunch, the depth and severity of which is still unfathomable, to say that there is no need for tighter regulation. Quite obviously, to the government, there is a need for it. And they will start to flesh out some of their proposals over the coming months.
And we know a bit more now about the deal, the Lloyds TSB takeover of HBOS. £12.2 billion. Do we know whether this will stabilise the markets as the city regulator hopes?
Well, as of last night, that remained a very moot point. And shares in Lloyds fell very heavily yesterday after the news. And there has to be some small doubt, I think, and probably growing doubt as the days go by, as to whether this deal will go through, whether Lloyds TSB shareholders will actually approve it or not if the share price continues to tank. What we know about the proposal is that in the discussions between Gordon Brown and Sir Victor Blank, the chairman of Lloyds TSB, earlier this week, a sort of grand bargain was struck, in that the government said that it would waive Britain's quite tough competition laws to allow this merger to take place, even though the combined bank will have something like 40% market share. And in return, the new big mega bank would agree to pump more money into the mortgage market to try and get the housing market restarted, particularly aimed at first-time buyers. So both sides get something out of the deal. That was broadly what was agreed. But as I say, the mood in the markets is still very, very nervous and jittery, and the central banks around the world pumped an extra $180 billion into markets yesterday with very little effect, it seemed. And Lloyd's share price fell quite heavily. So we'll be looking at that very closely today to see whether Lloyd's suffers as a result of taking on HBOS, which is seen as obviously quite a dicey operation in the current circumstances. The good joke going around the city is that the new bank will be called Halifax Lloyds of Scotland, or HLOS for short.
George Bush made a statement on the economy yesterday. He echoed Gordon Brown's insistence that his government would do whatever necessary to bring stability and security.
The Federal Reserve, in coordination with central banks around the world, took a substantial step to provide additional liquidity to the U.S. financial system. These actions are necessary and they're important, and the markets are adjusting to them. Our financial markets continue to deal with serious challenges. As our recent actions demonstrate, my administration is focused on meeting these challenges. The American people can be sure we will continue to act to strengthen and stabilize our financial markets and improve investor confidence. Thank you.
Despite the US government bailing out AIG, there's still a lot of uncertainty about the viability of Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs.
Yes, I mean, as of last night, the attention was really focused on Morgan Stanley. I mean, some analyst was saying that he thought Morgan Stanley would be bust before the end of this week and that Goldman's would be going the same way next week. So that's the indication of the mood. I mean, particularly the idea of Goldman Sachs, which is probably the most prestigious investment bank in the entire world, going belly up, is would have been totally inconceivable probably a fortnight ago. And yet here we are thinking, can Goldman Sachs survive this, you know, tsunami of selling in the financial markets? Morgan Stanley, I think, is quite pivotal to the mood of the markets at the end of what has obviously been a phenomenally traumatic week. And there were attempts last night to broker a takeover of Morgan Stanley, either by the Chinese government through its sovereign wealth fund or by a regional US bank, Wachovia, which is a very strange marriage, if you think about it, and quite humiliating for Morgan Stanley. And again, one of the blue-blooded giants of Wall Street to be taken over by a regional American bank. Again, something that you would not have conceived as possible two or three weeks ago.
Larry Elliott. So a tough week for Gordon Brown. And next week in Manchester, it's the Labour Party conference when the unpopular Prime Minister faces down his critics in the party. But Brown loyalists still claim the former Chancellor is the best man to lead us in times of economic uncertainty. I asked our columnist Martin Kettle about the political fallout from this extraordinary week.
Well, it's obviously an opportunity for him. He's had such dire ratings and Labour has had such appalling ratings recently that the opportunity to show strength and control and decisiveness in a major crisis, especially one in an area where he is experienced, having been Chancellor for 10 years, is an opportunity not to be missed. And he is grabbing it, partly because he has to, because government has a lot of responsibilities in this matter, but also because it's a political lifeline, he hopes, I think, for his own prospects and for Labour's prospects.
Next week, it's the Labour Party conference, of course. Will the economic uncertainty that we've seen over the last few days dampen the enthusiasm of those who want to force Gordon Brown out before the next election?
I certainly think that's another reason why there's not going to be an open challenge to Gordon Brown at the Manchester Labour Party conference. I think this current crisis poses a lot of really difficult questions for the Conservatives as well. And in some ways, they're more difficult because the Tory party is very much the party of deregulation. It started the Big Bang, which in a sense led to all of this. The party has not prepared itself with an economic or financial strategy of any kind yet. I mean, those matters are very much still under wraps in terms of the next general election. So, I mean, they're on the spot too, as to what they might do and what they might say.
Now, looking across the Atlantic, Martin, obviously the market turmoil has had an impact on the US presidential election. John McCain, by his own admission, the economy is not his strong point. Does that mean that Barack Obama's managed to regain some of the momentum he lost when Sarah Palin entered the electoral fray?
I think that what's happened in the United States is comparable to what's happened in Britain. It hasn't perhaps happened on such a big scale yet, may not do so. But what's really striking is that since the financial sector went pear-shaped in the United States, Barack Obama has been boosted in the polls. The polls are consistently coming his way again after some days in which the Palin effect appeared to be really causing him to stumble. Again, I think it's the same as with the Tories in Britain. Obama is the opposition, and therefore he is benefiting from voters' dismay at the way that events have turned out on the financial markets. And although McCain has always tried to put some space between himself and the Republican administration, you know, he is a Republican senator in what has been for most of the last 10 to 15 years a Republican-dominated Washington. And therefore, I think it seems to be that, you know, he is taking a hit for the weakness of the economy, and Obama is benefiting. And certainly that's what the Obama campaign think, because they're going hell for leather on this at the moment.
That's Martin Kettle. And the latest on the markets, of course, at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website today, an extract from a new book about globalisation by Chris Patton, guardian.co.uk/books. Bette Midler is interviewed by Emma Brooks at guardian.co.uk/arts. And the Ryder Cup begins tomorrow. Follow it at guardian.co.uk/sport. In Israel, the Foreign Minister Zippy Livni is talking to potential coalition partners today after winning the leadership election of the ruling party Kadima. Her victory means Israel is about to have its first female prime minister since Golda Meir in 1974. Ian Black's The Guardian's Middle East editor. He says it was a surprisingly narrow victory.
It's a very narrow victory indeed. It was, I think, just over 1%, and is yet another example of exit polls, which are notoriously unreliable, getting things very badly wrong. I think there's some red faces amongst political observers who were expecting her to win by a far larger margin. But nevertheless, she has won, and it's a, you know, it's a significant moment in the complex business of Israeli politics and how that fits into the great issues of war and peace and territory that are always on the agenda.
Livni's a former Mossad agent, a lawyer. What else do we know about her?
The Mossad agent bit obviously attracts a lot of attention. The only difficulty is that we know nothing about what she actually did. And for all we know, she could have been, she probably wasn't the cleaning lady, but we don't know what she did. And she did it for a short period when she was much younger. So it's not clear that it's of much relevance to her CV. She was a lawyer, as you say. She's quite a successful politician. She's been in politics for less than 10 years, and she's already, you know, she's about to become prime minister, which isn't bad. And the other thing about her is that she's going to be only the second woman prime minister that Israel has ever had after the redoubtable Golda Meir, who was prime minister in the 1970s. So that's quite a significant change. Otherwise, what difference is it going to make to anything? The main issues are clearly the familiar political ones, negotiations with the Palestinians, talks with Syria. And over all that, I think most people will be aware of the sense of a looming crisis with Iran, over Iran and its nuclear ambitions.
And although she comes from ostensibly a right-wing political background, she's been seen as quite a dovish figure.
Yeah, I mean, these terms are all relative. You know, Livni's shift represents a wider shift in Israeli society where people and parties which we used to call right-wing have shifted in their views more to the centre. That is, in a way, what the phenomenon of Kadima, the party she now heads, is all about. It's people who thought the Likud, the traditional right-wing party, was not moving sufficiently with the times, wanted to be more pragmatic and more realistic, and broke away under Ariel Sharon, who was replaced by Ehud Olmert, who Livni is now replacing in turn. So I'd say, you know, dovish isn't maybe quite the right word, but I think she's pragmatic, realistic, and she's been involved in talks with the Palestinians for the recent period. So she's well placed to know where things stand, at least on that crucial front.
Her election comes because of the difficulties Ehud Olmert has faced with corruption allegations. She's facing a big domestic challenge in convincing the public that she can clean up politics and restore the faith, people's faith in politicians again.
I think things sunk to a real low under Olmert. He always had a reputation as being a smart lawyer who liked a big cigar and a pretty lavish lifestyle. But I think the corruption allegations that they've been against him, which he denies, it has to be said, have really reinforced the impression that people at the top of the Israeli political system are more interested in feathering their own nests. Livni is Mrs. Clean. She has no such record. There's never been any suggestion that she's, you know, besmirched in any way by these sort of allegations. So that, I think, people are pleased about.
Ian Black. I'm John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, Thabo Mbeki, the South African president, could be removed from office within days.
Mbeki's facing a vote within the ANC National Executive that will decide whether he's asked to step down. What they call within the liberation movement his recalling because he's failed in office.
But first, Bulgaria has been a member of the European Union for 3 years now. But the European Commission has withheld funding until Bulgaria does more to tackle corruption and organised crime. A key test comes in November when two of the country's most notorious gangsters go on trial. Helen Pidd reports from Sofia.
So I'm here with Rustan Stefanov, who is coordinator of the economic programme at a think tank called the Centre for the Study of Democracy. Rustan, how bad is corruption in Bulgaria?
You have to put that into perspective, and you could use two measures. One is over time, the other is compared to other countries in the EU. If you use the first one, over time, and the Centre has been measuring corruption victimisation since 1998, we could say that by 2006 we've had a 50% decrease in administrative corruption. This means people and businesses meet with the administration, for example, giving bribes to doctors, to policemen, to customs officials. This has been the so-called petty administrative corruption. This has decreased by 50% since 1998. If we look at comparison with other EU countries, then one could say that Bulgaria is comparable to countries like Greece, Poland or Hungary on again on corruption victimization, and this is something that is comparable and that it could actually look at. The real problem about Bulgaria, this is what the EU has been demanding or insisting on, has been high-level political corruption. These are the connections, or the unregulated connections between businesses and the government, top government officials.
I'm here at the offices of the national newspaper 24 hours daily with Stanimir Vaglinov, who's an investigative journalist at the newspaper. So can you outline for me the kind of stories that you cover relating to corruption?
Well, I'm working mostly for economic issues. Some cases connected with organized crime and business. I investigated some cases connected with trade with babies here in Bulgaria. I was in island of Crete for the same reason. Some cases with trade with arms, smuggling.
We've been looking through various pictures of murders and dead bodies and things like that. Is it dangerous, your job, uncovering corruption and reporting on these criminals?
I'm doing very often an comparison between my work, for example, and miners. Every day they are going underground and they risk everything, in fact. It's the same with us. If you are a professionalist, if you know what to do and what not to do, of course there is a risk, but if you are careful, you have a lot of chance to survive. It's very important to show to everyone, including to these people from the underground, that you are working as a journalist, not as a part of another group or something like that. And this is the best way to survive. If they decide that you're doing some kind of order against them from some competitors or from the police or someone, it's very dangerous.
Hello, my name is Maria Yaneva. I'm sorry to say it, but I think that almost everybody in this country has some personal experience with corruption practices in one way or another. I personally have two cases, so to say, when I experienced corruption. So one of them was a case with my husband who needed to have surgery operation, quite a routine one, but for which he should wait for about a year if we should use our regular health insurance. state health insurance. We were advised by inside people and by friends who were doctors to go to a certain surgeon to pay a relatively small amount of money or bearable amount of money, so to say.
And how did you feel when you handed over that money?
Well, not quite well. I actually didn't know how to proceed, whether to simply to put this money in a sealed envelope and give them to the doctor, or it was simpler than I thought, but I don't felt quite comfortable, I have to say.
Helen Pidd reporting from Sofia.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
In South Africa, leaders of the ruling African National Congress meet this weekend to consider the future of President Thabo Mbeki. Last week, a judge threw out corruption charges against Mbeki's political rival, Jacob Zuma. The court ruled that the decision to press charges against Zuma had been politically motivated, that Mbeki had influenced the prosecutors. So, are Mbeki's days numbered? The Guardian's Africa editor is Chris McGreal.
Mbeki's facing a vote within the ANC National Executive that will decide whether he's asked to step down. What they call within the liberation movement his recalling, because he's failed in office. And if he fails to heed a call to step down, then they say that they will have a vote in Parliament to remove him from office, either with a simple majority to a vote of no confidence in the government, which would force an early election, or a two-thirds majority to impeach him.
And there have been reports that ANC officials are already discussing an exit strategy with Mbeki.
Yes, I mean, the ANC is itself divided. There are those within the upper echelons of the ANC and also within the Communist Party, parts of the unions, the ANC Youth League, who are very set against Mbeki and want him out as soon as possible. These include the ANC Treasurer Matthews Poser, who has a long-running feud with Mbeki. There are others, such as Jacob Zuma himself, who are more cautious. They wonder whether removing Mbeki from office it would not damage the party and cost it votes when there's an election in May anyway, and Mbeki's term in office would be up. Zuma earlier this week told party activists that there was no point in continuing to beat a dead snake. So there's very, very much division. I think that Mbeki's still in with a chance of surviving, particularly if Zuma's able to stamp his authority and say that he doesn't want Mbeki brought down.
Meanwhile, Chris, in Zimbabwe, President Robert Mugabe and the Prime Minister-designate, Morgan Tsvangirai, they've agreed to share power, but they still can't agree on who should be in the cabinet.
No, there's a considerable amount of wrangling going on between the two, and also wrangling within ZANU-PF itself, particularly between those hardliners who feel that Mugabe signed away too much, that they should have continued essentially to bludgeon their way to keeping control. Mugabe himself told a meeting of the Central Committee of ZANU-PF yesterday that he had had to bow to the pressure because ZANU-PF had lost the election in March. He blamed the party. He pointed to the men at the table and said, it's your fault and we've got to face reality. But it seems that there's certainly some resistance to doing that. There are reports that the hardliners within ZANU-PF are saying that they're not prepared to give away any of the security ministries. That includes anything that controls the military or the police. And they want to keep their hands on the finance ministry. It seems rather unlikely that they'll get their way because, amongst other things, foreign donors are certainly not going to be giving any aid via a ZANU-PF finance minister.
Chris McGreal. Phil Maynard produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.